Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. This is Thursday, March 19th. And first, I want to make a few announcements and let you know a little bit of a schedule change. Senate Bill 193 and 194, the paperwork was not complete on that, so we will be carrying over the work sessions until next Tuesday. And what's the date next Tuesday, just for folks that are listening?
24th.
March 24th. Thank you, Senator Prezonsky. And we're going to do the work sessions first because we're waiting for Senator Johnson, who's going to testify in Senate Bill 622. We have a number of work sessions that we're going to work through quickly today. The first one is on Senate Bill 768, and this is a work session solely for the purposes of passing it on to another committee. So with that, I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 768, and I will take a motion.
Madam Chair, I would move that we take this bill, Senate Bill 768, and move it to the Committee on Finance and Revenue.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves Senate Bill 768 without a recommendation. Did I hear that?
That's what you heard.
And requested it be referred to the Committee on Finance and Revenue. Is there discussion?
Your Honor. Oh, Your Honor.
You never know.
I look at this, and it has a great relating clause to the first beginning relating to malt beverage, but then it has cost recovery fees, so I have no objection.
Now, I saw this. I thought I'd woken up and gone to heaven, actually, but it is... It is at the request of the Senate President that this bill be referred to the Revenue Committee. Any other discussion?
For some of us woke up and thought we'd gone the other direction.
Well, I have a great alternative to what the Chair wanted, but she...
Okay, any objections? Senator Boquist.
I'll object.
To moving it on to Revenue? Right. Okay. So noted. For the record.
For the record.
Yes.
That we don't know how it's categorized.
Right.
Okay. With that, the motion passes, and the measure is sent to the Committee on Finance and Revenue. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 768. I will now open up a work session on Senate Bill 108. And, Beth, if you can remind the committee about this bill.
We heard Senate Bill 108 on the 26th, and... what you heard was the proposed -1 amendment, and since then, Senator Boquist helped us in requesting a -2 amendment, which replaces the text of the bill and requires that students participating in the diagnosis and treatment of animals are engaged in an approved educational program by the board or a college of veterinary medicine accredited by the American Veterinary Medical Association. Requires that students be under the direct supervision of an Oregon licensed veterinarian or a veterinarian approved by the board or OSU.
Okay. Senator Boquist, would you like to speak about the amendment?
Just to clarify, if everybody recalls this, and Beth did a good job of this, we talked to the university to ensure that we could have people from cross-border universities coming over and doing, for better word, their residencies for veterinarian in our schools so that we wouldn't have a negative impact in some of our rural areas in the east and the south, so on and so forth. And the wording here came from the university. So.
Okay. And I wanted to thank you for your work on that amendment. Are there any other questions for Beth? Okay. So with that, we are in a work session. I will take a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the -2s into Senate Bill 108.
Okay. Senator Boquist has made a motion to move the they're -1s, aren't they?
-2s.
They say -2s, ma'am.
Where are the -2s?
I have no clue what a -1 is.
Okay, thank you.
The -2s
dated March 11th, 2009 into Senate Bill 108. Is there any discussion? Okay, any objections? Seeing none, the -2s are adopted.
Madam Chair, move the bill as amended for the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves Senate Bill 108 with the -2s, the due pass to the floor. We'll do a roll call for this, please. Actually, I'd like to ask if there's any discussion on the full bill with the -2 amendments. Okay, seeing none, we'll do a roll call.
Senator Lopez?
Aye.
Aye. Senator Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
Yes.
Aye. With that, the motion carries, and I will ask Senator Boquist
Thank you, Madam Chair.
To carry it to the floor.
Why did I see that coming?
Yeah. Why did I write it down already?
Yes. Okay, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 108. And we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 629. Beth?
Madam Chair and Committee, Senate Bill 629 requires that the State Department of Agriculture establish a grant program for assisting counties in carrying out weed control district duties, functions, and powers. Before you, you also have the Dash 1 amendments, which were requested by the proponent of the bill, which would remove the funding structure and the allocation of funds to the grant program. There's a no revenue impact on this and a minimal fiscal impact with no statement issued.
And no subsequent referral?
There actually is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means on this bill.
With a minimal fiscal?
Yes.
Okay. All right, so I will take any, would you like to make any comments on this one? Because you've worked on this
right,
one as
yeah,
well, Senator.
Madam Chair, what we're trying to do is set up a structure so that we could get grant funds or utilize funds for these programs in the future. We know there's no funding right now, but we also know there was no authority to set up the structure and issue the grants should we find federal dollars or something along that line. So, and with that, Madam Chair, we're in a work session. I'd move the Dash 1s to 629.
Okay, Senator Boquist has made a motion for adoption of the Dash 1s of Senate Bill 629. Is there any discussion? I would just like to thank Senator Boquist for working on this one as well and appreciate you working with the counties and the weed districts on this. Seeing none, the Dash 1s are adopted, and I'll accept another motion.
Madam Chair, move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Atkinson has moved Senate Bill 629 as amended with the Dash 1s for a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Does this go to Ways and Means?
I'm sorry, no. With the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay.
You amend your motion?
I amend my motion post with to say send it to Ways and Means post haste.
Okay. So with that, the motion is amended. The Dash 1s has been adopted. Due pass recommendation, send it on to Ways and Means. Any discussion? Seeing none, would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
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 Yes.
Okay. Aye. With that, the motion carries. Senate Bill 629 is adopted with the Dash 1s. It's sent down to Ways and Means. We won't assign a carrier because it will probably be carried by somebody at Ways and Means. So with that, I will close the work session for Senate Bill 629. And we'll open up a work session on our last bill, Senate Bill 631. Yes.
Senate Bill 631 prohibits cleaning agents used in automatic dishwashers to be sold, offered for sale, or distributed in Oregon if they contain 8.7% or more of phosphorus by weight. The Dash 1 amendment that you have before you provides an exemption for a cleaning agent used in commercial dishwashers. It extends the effective date of the prohibition to July 1st, 2010, as well as authorizes DEQ to adopt rules before that point if necessary. Just for the record, also the July 1st, 2010 date did put the bill in line with the 12 other states that passed the similar legislation.
Okay, thank you. And colleagues, you will recall, since this is my bill, I guess I can speak to this. We did hear testimony from the Soap and Detergent Association. They had a suggestion for the amendment. That's where the amendment came from. And yes, just as a reminder. And so that's the amendment that you see before you. We did not hear any opposition to this bill, I recall. Right, we only had support. Okay. So with that, I would accept a motion.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1s in the Senate Bill 631.
Okay. Senator Przanski moves adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 631. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the Dash 1s are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 631 to the floor as amended to the, with the due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Przanski has made a motion to move Senate Bill 631.
It was less than
8.7%. As adopted with the Dash 1 amendment dated March 12, 2009, with a due pass recommendation. Is any discussion? Okay, seeing none, call the roll, please.
Yes.
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye. With that, the motion carries, and since I am the chief sponsor of this bill, I will carry it on the floor. So with that, we'll close the work session for Senate Bill 631. I do not see Senator Johnson here yet. So we'll go ahead and open up a public hearing then on Senate Bill 105. Thank you. Okay, Beth, take us away.
Madam Chair and Committee, Senate Bill 105 increases maximum penalties for violations of environmental laws, and there is an amendment to it that I think the DEQ people will speak to as well.
Okay, who I think are coming up in anticipation of that. All right, thank you, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. My name is Greg Aldridge with the Department of Environmental Quality. And with me today is Les Carlo with our Department of Program of Compliance and Enforcement. And we're here to talk about Senate Bill 105, which increases maximum penalties for violations of environmental law. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Les to do a brief overview.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, as Greg said, my name is Les Carl. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor in DEQ's Office of Compliance and Enforcement. I urge your support of Senate Bill 105. In 1973, Oregon adopted statutory maximum penalties generally applicable to violations of pollution control laws of $10,000. That was 25 years ago. And that $10,000 statutory maximum has continued today. During that intervening 25 years, however, inflation has chipped away at the actual value of $10,000, so that a $10,000 penalty assessed today would only be worth about 20 to 25% of the actual value as intended in 1973. We're concerned that some potential violators may not be taking these penalties as seriously as they should, and that this lower amount might interfere with our primary duties of creating deterrence and stimulating compliance. The bill raises that maximum statutory amount from $10,000 to $25,000 for most pollution control violations. Now, I want to be clear that that the bill only increases the potential maximum amount. It doesn't require that the full $25,000 be assessed in any particular case. The dollar amount of the penalty is currently set according to factors that are in DEQ's governing statutes and penalty formula rules that are in DEQ's operating rules. So that process wouldn't change. Indeed, until the rules are changed, changing the statutory maximum wouldn't change the size of the penalties DEQ assesses at all. The bill also makes a number of changes I'd like to mention a couple of these. The bill follows the state of Washington's lead in increasing penalties assessed for negligent or intentional spills of oil into waters of the state. And it increases that penalty from $20,000 to a statutory maximum of $100,000. And in addition, the bill does a couple of similar changes regarding a couple of similar violations. In particular, it increases to $100,000 the negligent or intentional spill of hazardous materials into waters of the state, such things that might not be included as oil, but would have the same sorts of environmental damage, things like xylene, methanol, PCBs, solvents like TCE and other materials like that. And the bill also increases to $100,000 the failure to clean up a spill of hazardous materials if done negligently or intentionally into waters of the state. The bill also increases what we call the super penalty, which applies in cases that create the likelihood of extreme hazard to public health or extensive environmental damage. And the bill increases that super penalty from $100,000 to $250,000. The last one I wanted to mention was that when the Environmental Crimes Act was adopted in 1993, it set out penalties for certain misdemeanor or felonious violations of pollution control laws. But it didn't specify that the fines under those offenses would apply to everyone, including corporations. The result is that there's a provision in the criminal code that specifies if the offense itself doesn't specifically apply a fine under an offense to a corporation, then this code this provision in the criminal code specifies an alternative code. The result is that under the Environmental Crimes Act, the penalties applicable to corporations are less than the penalties applicable to any other person or entity. The bill clarifies that corporations should pay the same fine for environmental crimes as any other individual. DEQ is committed to creating a healthier environment for all Oregonians by ensuring that people and businesses comply with environmental laws. The changes proposed in the bill support that effort by enhancing the authorities and the tools that we use to make that happen. Also, I want to mention that I've spoken with John Ledger from AOI, and I believe he's going to offer a suggestion on the bill. I believe we'd be generally in support of his suggestion, of his concept, and we're willing to work with him on that. So if you have any questions for me now on the bill or any questions for me later after Mr. Ledger testifies, I'd be glad to answer them. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any questions? Senator Boquist and Senator House afterwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just three things, if you could just touch briefly on it. Could you try and explain the fish and wildlife portion in here? Because I see it's deleted, and I haven't drug out the ORS to figure out where it's going to. But if you could explain that as one. Two, I'm assuming that these civil penalties are then covered by, you know, the administrative law procedures for appeal, so on and so forth. And then the third thing is, where do the penalties actually go to your agency or general fund or where? Thank you, Madam Chair.
All good questions. Thank you, Senator Boquist.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist, on the first issue, we are striking a portion of the code that creates penalties for environmental damage, particular damage to individual species created from certain discharges of hazardous materials. There are provisions in Chapter 466 for that. There are also provisions in ORS 496 that govern the same species. So basically there's two sets of penalties established in the ORSs for damage to these individual species. All we're doing with this amendment is eliminating ours and referring to the penalties established in ORS 496, which I believe were updated more recently than those in 466. On the second question, ORS 183 and all of the procedural rules apply to all of our actions currently and would certainly apply to any actions taken under the new penalties of Senate Bill 105. On the third question about where the penalties go, currently most penalties that are assessed and collected by DEQ go to the general fund. There are some exceptions for that. There are penalties in the tanks program that go to a tanks fund. There are certain penalties that go to a spill fund for violations, for certain penalties assessed in the spills program. Those are basically the exceptions. Most of it goes to the general fund.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator House and then Senator Atkinson.
Can you tell me how you arrived at that figure going from 10,000 to 25,000? I mean, why that figure, why that high, why now, and where that puts Oregon in line with other states for similar offenses?
Yeah. Chair Dingfelder, Senator Haas, we did try to do an analysis of what's going on in other states in this matter. It turns out to be a difficult thing to create a table of all the states and do a full analysis like that. But of the states that we looked at, no state has less than $10,000 per violation per day. The reason for that is that that's the federal minimum for delegating these programs, or the federal programs, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Hazardous Waste Law, and others. That's the federal minimum allowable for administration of those programs. So no state has less than that administers these programs. most states have more than $10,000, at least for some programs. And the typical statutory maximum was $25,000. So that's where we settle on. There are states that have more than that, and there are states that differ for different programs. Maybe just one other comment. It's also, the $25,000 is also less than the federal maximum penalty that would apply in these program areas, which was increased 2 months ago to $37,500 per violation per day.
That's the federal maximum?
That's the federal maximum for violations enforced by the federal government, not violations of federal law enforced by Oregon.
Got it. Yeah. Thank you. Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. I apologize. I had to stand out for just a moment while you're making your argument. Could you just tell me the basic position of government through Department of Environmental Quality? Is Oregon corporations just run amok right now with pollution?
Senator Nienfelder, Senator Atkinson, no, sir, not to the best of our knowledge. Most businesses in Oregon, we believe, are in compliance and trying as well as they can to meet environmental laws. I believe you're referring to the bill's suggestion that we make corporations pay the same penalty as others, and so that's just a matter of fairness for all individuals and the entities, whether they're incorporated or not, to pay the same penalty.
Follow up.
Then I fail. If we don't have a huge problem, why are we raising the fine? You've lost me there. You haven't got over the basic hurdle of why do we need this.
May I ask a question, Senator Nienfelder? Senator Atkinson, you mean raise the? Do you mean eliminate the current exemption for corporations, or you mean raise the penalties altogether?
Bill 105.
Oh, Senator, I see. Okay.
They did say that at the beginning. So if you want to reiterate it,
I see. I understand now. I was answering the wrong question. I apologize for that, Senator Nienfelder, Senator Atkinson. So. The idea here is that the statutory maximum of $10,000 was set back in 1973 at a time when $10,000 was equivalent of a certain amount of money. Through inflation, $10,000 now is only worth 20 to 25% of its originally intended value. So that $10,000 penalty assessed today would only be worth $2,000, $2,500, something like that. So the penalties have lost their potency over the last 25 years. So a couple of things make us believe that a change should be recommended. One is the loss of potency, and we're afraid that those businesses who might violate might not take penalties as seriously as they ought. So that's one reason. And the other is that other states who do have higher penalties, higher statutory maximums, we want to follow along there so that we don't become the state where environmental violations, environmental crimes have the least penalties.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, with that, stick around. There may be some follow-up. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And actually, I'm going to call up the other folks who have signed up. Brian Wagner from the Tualatin Riverkeepers and John Ledger from AOI. Is John here? It's not.
He's
okay,
been
Brian.
In and out.
It take a minute to plug in here.
Okay. We'll see if we can get John in the meantime. John, if you're listening, your time is here.
He's just outside of Melbourne earlier. There he is.
Ask and you shall receive.
Yes. Come on up. John, why don't you get started while Brian is loading his hopefully not too very long presentation, Brian.
Members of the committee, I'm John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries. Just have a couple of comments on the bill. First of all, I think... there's some pieces of this that are actually, I think, pretty good. One, I was surprised that the maximum limit, frankly, for a civil penalty for something I think was referred, I can't remember the term, but for essentially catastrophic releases was only $100,000, and this raises it to $250,000. And I don't think that's unreasonable. That's on page six. I guess I would start off by saying I think I want to think a little bit about what it is everybody wants to do here and what the problem is that's being solved. When there are violations, there are a couple of different kinds of violations, and certainly when there are violations that give people a competitive edge, especially, our members have no sympathy for that. And we don't like to see it going on. And people that make decisions to violate the law, we have no sympathy with them at all. There are a lot of violations that take place that I would... It's a difference between going 150 miles an hour down the highway and doing what I did yesterday, driving the wrong way on 12th to get into AOI, getting a traffic ticket. And there are a lot of violations like that, where you do a stack test, instead of 10 pounds an hour, it's 12 pounds an hour, 15 pounds an hour. And one of the things on these violations is every day is a separate violation. And we're just talking maximums here and understanding there would be a framework behind this that would tier these, but for the maximum, it's $10,000 a day, which adds up over, and they go back every day of operation where there's an assumed violation because the plant was operating, so that's $300,000 versus a maximum potential of $750,000. So, I mean, it's a substantial increase for the potential. And our concerns also, would this spur more litigation? There's very little litigation between companies and the DEQ now. And I'm a little concerned about whether this would raise litigation. And that, of course, would come back on the DEQ budget to fund that.
John, could you expand on why you would think this would increase litigation?
Well, because if the amount of penalty goes up, it increases the chances that the corporation will fight it. It's that simple. And that's a pretty hefty, it's 250% bump.
Right.
And
almost 40 years.
Yeah. Another thing to kind of bear in mind in looking at this is the relationship between federal and state enforcement. And I used to have Andy Ginsberg position when I was running air programs in another state. And one of the interesting things is there can be on air sources, for instance, where your rules are promulgated in the Federal Register. They're enforceable by the federal government independently. And we used to do this, where there would be an enforcement action against a company where you'd be subject to the fines, and the federal government could overfile and do the exact same enforcement action with more fines at the same time. So you kind of have this odd double jeopardy that you're running into where the fines compound. So because there's civil penalties, if you have an emission violation, the state penalizes you, the federal government can do what's called an overfile, penalize you also. So you pay a federal fine and a state fine.
Madam Chair.
Senator Przanski.
But also under criminal law, if you have an individual that commits a crime that could be prosecuted in both the federal system and the state system, but that wouldn't be considered double jeopardy. It's just that each of them could do it. Normally, my understanding, I'm not sure in this area, if they kind of divvy it up, like depending on the magnitude of the violation, sometimes I know on the criminal side, again, you'll have the federal U.S. Attorney's Office coming in and taking cases that we as a state may give up, knowing that they're going to go through the federal system.
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, it sounds very similar.
Okay.
I think, we're not anxious to see this pass, obviously. One of the reasons is that it does occur in the middle of a pretty nasty recession that is hard on businesses. We understand what DEQ wants to do, and we understand it's been a while since the penalties were raised. I would ask if you do think this is needed, if you do, and you wish to pass the bill, I think it might be wise to look at perhaps the enactment date or when it becomes effective. It's going to take DEQ some time to do the rules, and I think probably if you do choose to pass this and the effective date was pushed out in the distance some time where everyone would know this was coming. Maybe with any luck we'd be out of the recession. I think that's an option you might want to look at.
Thank you, Mr. Ledger. Any questions for Mr. Ledger? Senator Prozonsky?
I'm not sure if you were in the room, but when DEQ was giving their testimony, they talked about the length of time since they have had any, let's say, change in the amount of the fines. And the fines are actually set up, as when you look at the bill, for individuals. And it isn't until you get to Section 11 where it states that basically a corporation would be fined at the same level as an individual. So my questions would be, are you suggesting that either we come in with a lesser fine that would be equitable for both individuals and corporations? Are you asking that corporations be held to a, I'm not going to say lower standard, but a lower amount of a fine as compared to what's been proposed for individuals?
Madam Chairman, Senator Prozonsky, I think there's a lot to be, we don't have an argument with things being equitable. And I want you to know that if people are willfully violating the law, we don't have a lot of sympathy for that. But there are a lot of violations that occur. A lot of times people get into situations where they do incur penalties, and we're a little concerned about the jump in that, especially during a recession. I don't know if the legislature wants to do a big jump on penalties while there's a major recession going on. But if you decide to go down that route, I would suggest that you defer the date of enactment, date of that would become effective.
Yeah, just clarification again. I just want to make certain we know exactly where you're suggesting us to go. Is it because of the recession you think that the fines that are being proposed should be less than they are for both individuals and corporations, or are you saying that because of the situation, individuals should be able to be fined at a higher amount than the corporation? I understand you said it should be equitable, but I'm not sure which way you're asking.
Madam Chair Prozonsky, we have no problem with them being the same. Ideally, we'd like things to stay the same.
Okay.
However, if you choose, I mean, this is a little bit of a hard one for us because a lot of times penalties occur and they're kind of unbeknownst to people and they're emissions, they come across them. And this over time, this obviously through the rule process, all those numbers are going to go up. And on the other hand, when people willfully violate, we don't have a lot of sympathy for that. So this is a very dicey thing. And the other thing, frankly, we are concerned about is in the middle of a very difficult recession, if the legislature wants to go on record of making fines go up 250%.
And, John, I don't know if you were here, but we asked how this related to other states, and it's fairly comparable with what other states have, what is being proposed here. So just in case you missed that. Okay, Brian, we have about 5 minutes max for your presentation because we have another, we have a senator who's waiting outside to kick off her bill.
Senator Dingfelder and committee, thank you for the opportunity. I wanted to reply to Senator Atkinson's question about whether or not we're running amok with environmental violations and is there a need for this bill. The issue we find is that one bad apple spoils the whole bunch. And even though it's the rare business or rare individual who commits these environmental violations, they can do a whole lot of damage. Each individual one. And we're supportive of this increase in the penalties. I looked at the enforcement actions database online that DEQ has, and rarely did the penalties amount to the $10,000 daily limit, the entire penalty. So the distribution of these, I would expect that the distribution of penalties would probably go up very little because of this, but it does provide an extra incentive to play by the rules. One of the things we also think to help with enforcement is we need to have a willingness and a capability to enforce environmental regulations in not only in DEQ but other natural resources agencies, including Department of Agriculture and Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. The picture you're seeing here is taken on the Tualatin River last July. This is toxic blue-green algae, produces a variety of toxins. State Department of Human Services put a health advisory on the lower Tualatin River for 2 weeks, warning people to keep their animals, pets, themselves out of the water. Do not ingest the water. Wash off if you get exposed to this because of neurotoxins, liver toxins, and potential carcinogens produced by these blue-green algae. U.S. Geological Survey traced the source of this outbreak. Because it hadn't ever happened on the Tualatin River, we haven't had an outbreak like this for 30 years since the Scoggins Dam was installed, and we have lots of clean flows. They traced it back to here, to Wapato Improvement District. This is the discharge from Wapato Improvement District, which goes through a canal owned by Tualatin Valley Irrigation District into the Tualatin River. Water quality standards readings taken by USGS and the Joint Water Commission would show that there's violations of Oregon's water quality standards and TMDLs for phosphorus, turbidity, dissolved oxygen in this water. And we called DEQ about this and Department of Agriculture. Department of Agriculture told us that they don't regulate districts like this drainage district or the irrigation district. They regulate farmers. So we called DEQ. DEQ said, oh, this is agriculture. Call them. We said agriculture told us to call you. And then we showed them pictures of the dead fish. And they said, well, there's dead fish, and this must be ODFW's problem. There was hundreds of dead fish. This one wasn't quite dead. You can see it was swimming in circles. So finally, after getting nowhere with the state agencies, we called the television stations and got TV cameras out there. And the next day, DEQ was out there with their mobile lab taking samples. The problem is with these fines is they go into the general fund. And DEQ, it costs them to respond, and the other state agencies, it costs them to respond to these emergencies, to go out and to do the investigations, to take the samples, to do the testings, and do the enforcement actions. So they have a disincentive for enforcing these laws. Now, what we would propose is that these fines would go into a fund that reimburses agencies for their enforcement and investigation costs. We further investigated. We got a call from some of the farmers out there, and this is you can see the wilt on this broccoli crop, and the next slide shows a beet crop that stopped growing when it was irrigated with this water from Wapato Lake. That's Farmer Steve Dyke there, who was exposed to this blue-green algae earlier in the season before it got to the lower river. He also put this on black-capped berries. He talked with Department of Agriculture, the Extension Service, NRCS, and finally, Alan Milligan and another plant pathologist from OSU went out there, and they found that the crop damage, because these crops stopped growing, was consistent with microcystin. Microcystin is produced by blue-green algae. And Dr. Milligan also put in together a research summary, which is included in your packet, that shows that crops can take up these toxins and pass them on to the consumers. And the research is we need to know a whole lot more about this. But these crops went to market. ODA did not know what to do. They didn't tell us to do. And not only that, but we have soil samples and crop samples in Dr. Milligan's freezer in Corvallis, and we've repeatedly asked ODA and DEQ to test these crops to see if they really did take up these toxins, and they haven't yet. And their concern is that if the preliminary tests indicate they're toxins, it would cost $8,000 to determine if it had the specific toxins of concern. And so here we have a safety issue for the public that's not being addressed because these agencies are penalized. It costs them to enforce and investigate. And so that's why we think these penalties should go into a fund to support their efforts to protect Oregon from these pollution incidents. The cost, what your concern about the cost of raising these penalties during a recession, well, the recession is hitting everybody, and these pollution incidents cost a lot of people. The Joint Water Commission, which has a drinking water plant 6 miles downstream from this discharge, did a partial accounting of their costs that totaled up to $285,000 for additional costs of filtration because they were finding jasmine, a chemical produced by blue-green algae, in the drinking water, and they got over 200 phone call complaints before they acted because the drinking water stinks and tastes bad. And it's not a health risk, but it's a taste risk. So it's expended at least $285,000responding to this discharge. It doesn't account for the amount of bottled water that the drinking water customers from the Joint Water Commission paid for because they were avoiding the drinking water. It doesn't account for the additional filtration costs that Intel, who relies on very pure water from Joint Water Commission. It doesn't account for the 2 weeks lost revenue that Alder Creek Canoe and Kayak lost at their outfitting in Browns Ferry Park, nor does it cost for the 2 weeks of lost wages the college student who runs that operation lost because he was laid off for 2 weeks during this outbreak. And further, the additional monitoring costs that U.S. Geological Survey did, the posting and investigation that Tualatin Riverkeeper did, none of this was reimbursed. And so I think the penalty is the least economic impact of these discharges. The greater impact is the cost of that these downstream of the downstream impacts of these kind of things.
I'm going to have to ask you to start wrapping up.
Okay. So our suggestion is for this money to go into a fund that that will reimburse agencies for their investigation and enforcement costs, and so they are more fully enabled to protect Oregon from these pollution incidents.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian. And this is, colleagues, my former watershed, so it's sort of very difficult to look at these pictures. But with that, see if there's any questions. Senator Atkinson, and this is in, by the way, the river runs through Senator Hass's district.
We know.
Brian, I like your suggestion a lot on the pool fund. On this example, though, who would pay the fine?
The violation is of ORS 468B125, which says that no one may discharge pollutants without a permit. Wapato Improvement District ran these pumps for 2 months and never stopped them. Indeed, no agency told them to stop them. So they were violating ORS 468B. That would be the violation that would be fined.
Are they a corporation or are they a nonprofit?
They're a nonprofit corporation, is my understanding. They're a drainage district.
Would that special district be covered in the definitions of 105? That's my question.
Can DEQ answer that? Why don't you come up, please? Did you hear the question?
I did.
And state your name for the record again, please.
For the record, my name is Les Carlo. I'm in DEQ. I believe the question is, would a nonprofit corporation be covered under Senate Bill 105 modifies the penalty provisions of chapter 468 and a little bit in 468B, and the term person in there would apply to nonprofit corporations. So Senate Bill 105 doesn't disturb that at all.
Madam Chair,
Senator Prezant.
Assuming the same would be for special districts.
I assume.
Because it's a special district.
Yeah. I believe that's correct.
Okay, yes.
I might just add very quickly.
Very quickly.
We have all. It is very nice when someone gets fined. They come up to me all the time. They go, DEQ fined me. They just want more money in their budget. They just want more money for their programs. And it is great, frankly, to be able to say no. It goes into the general fund. It is an absolutely independent decision. And once you start taking penalty money and running it into an agency fund, you run into all kinds of recriminations, and it just clogs the whole thing up. If you want to take money out of the general fund and put it into that fund, you know how much money is coming in on penalties, but funding agency programs through penalties opens up horrible cans of worms.
All right, thank you for the comment. Last question, please.
Well,
you have a senator who's on deck waiting.
Just a moment, Senator Johnson. I want you to answer the same question on the liability chain for that farmer. Is that farmer going to pay the same fine under 105 as a corporation? And number two, if a government is found as the pollutant, does the government pay? Does a city pay the same fine found in 105?
Senator Dingfelder, Senator Atkinson, currently
Currently, the civil penalties assessed through our administrative process are the same regardless of what type of person it is, natural person, individual, trust, estate, corporation, nonprofit corporation. All of those are assessed the same penalty under Chapter 468, and that wouldn't change under Senate Bill 105. The only change is that currently there's this this what we believe is an artifact of the criminal code that creates lower penalties for corporations. We believe it's inadvertent. That's the only change that we're seeking to make.
So just for clarification, that's an existing statute, and all this does is this. What this bill doesn't change that except for the corporation portion, and it does increase the ceiling of the amount of fine that we can levy.
Senator, the answer is yes. All we're doing is making clear that provision in the criminal code doesn't apply to the environmental offenses in ORS Chapter 468, so that the penalty values set out in 468 would apply to everyone, including corporations.
All right. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Clear as mud, Madam Chair, but maybe they can get together with me afterwards.
Okay. If you could visit with Senator Boquist afterwards to make sure questions are answered. Okay, with that, is there anybody else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 105? Okay, seeing none, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 105. We'll now open up a hearing on Senate Bill 622, and Beth, if you can provide us with an overview, please.
Senate Bill 622 creates the Task Force on Geese Control to study issues raised by the increasing number of various species of geese and make recommendations as to how to control the geese population. Just for the committee's awareness also, that there is a -2 amendment that has been submitted that would add the requirement that one of the 9 members appointed to the task force would represent aviation, and it also expands the task force recommendation to include the impact of geese populations.
Okay, thank you, Beth. And with that, I'd like to invite Senator Johnson. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you for your courtesy. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16. In the audience is Marie Gadotti, at whose request I introduced this legislation, and some other folks who were instrumental in first talking to me about this. I don't know whether or not you would entertain them simultaneously.
Absolutely. So that's Marie Gadotti, and
we got 3 chairs, so
yeah.
Pick 2.
Come on up. Okay. Thank you.
And just to start off, do you want to introduce yourselves into the record?
My name is Marie Gadotti, and I live in Scappoose, Columbia County.
I'm Ron Dobbin. I live in Hillsboro, Oregon.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me just briefly set the stage. My district appears to be a uniquely desirable area for geese. I was so eloquently quoted in the Oregonian, and I might as well repeat it here, saying what they don't eat, they stomp on. What they don't stomp on, they poop on, and it has gotten to be a real problem. I think the aviation piece of this was evident by the heroic pictures that you saw of the plane that was landed in the Hudson River, and we can make that as a separate case. It's certainly aviation issues should certainly be included in this discussion. What we had originally started out to do was to bring forward a financial request looking for money for predator and geese depredation control, and it became clear as the financial picture darkened through the fall that asking for money in this legislature was not going to be a prudent thing to do, and so we stepped back our original request to now form a task force at which table all of the issues relative to the damage to agriculture, the threat to aviation, and various remedies could be discussed in a thoughtful way. By virtue of doing this bill, the task force would have legislative imprimatur on it to work with other agencies, the federal government. They would be able to call in different experts to help try to figure out what might be a recommendation to the February session or the 2011 session with respect to this increasingly serious problem. And I think you will hear from the farmers that are with me that this is a fiscal issue of huge magnitude. Is not just restricted to Northwest Oregon. There are geese issues all over the state. But Marie, who has been a member of the Farm Bureau's board, has been a particularly active advocate around this issue and the need to call to the attention of the legislature the economic and safety damage created by these huge flocks of birds. I would just add that the other day I was working in my office in Scappoose, which happens to be located at an airport, and a black cloud descended down over the field. I got in my car and chased them, honking the horn at probably 35 miles an hour. They just barely could look up enough to get out of the way. And when they finally left, they departed, and again, this large black cloud. I'll bet you there were 2,000 of them. This is a huge problem, and so I commend it for your consideration and hope you listen to the testimony of the farmers as they make their case for why this task force is essential.
Thank you, Senator Thompson.
Yes, as I said, my name is Marie Gadotti. I'm a full-time farmer, and I also represent the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation as the Goose Committee Chair. I want to thank you for letting me come here today, and I also want to thank Senator Johnson for bringing this bill forward for us. In the packet that I've put together for you, there is 4 pages of highlighted things that we have done since 1974 on this issue, and when you have time to read it, I would appreciate that. I'm going to keep my testimony brief today on all the other issues you have.
Thank you.
And I also would like to say that flock of geese that Senator Johnson was so advocately moving were onto my fields.
I chased them off the airport and sent them over to her place.
So, and even coming here today, it's always a joke, is which farmer's not going to be home so that the other farmer can chase the geese onto their fields. That's really, it sounds funny, but that's really our problem. It's a critical issue, and we've been dealing with it for a long time. When we started farming in 1970, it was a rare occasion to even see a goose of any species. We today there's upwards of 10,000 to 20,000 birds in our fields on a daily basis until they either annihilate the crop totally or have to wait for it to go back again so they can get the second munch. We, as well as hundreds of other farmers, have lost tens of thousands of dollars and more to this problem. The farmers involved throughout this process have done so with their own money and time. The fact that I'm before you today is evidence that we have been unsuccessful in making the agencies who are in control of these birds, in particular U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, to manage the population so they do not feed on private land. All we want to do is be able to farm profitable and keep our food that we grow for consumers safe. I do not know where else to go. We need your help to support this bill and the amendment that's been presented to you and put the task force together and try to come up with solutions for the agricultural producers of this state.
Again, I'm Ron Dobbin. I'm from the Hillsborough area. I also used to farm in Columbia County. The problem showed up in Columbia County quite some time before it did in Washington County. And another thing that we need to talk about here is local birds, which we call residents, versus the migratory ones. In Washington County, we never had a problem prior to 1987. At that time, there were a couple things happening. One is the local reserves were raising birds for viewing. Also, there was a grant put forward for biomass, which took 8,800 acres along the Columbia River to plant hybrid cottonwood trees. At that particular time, they started moving across the mountain and showing up in the Washington County areas. Let's see. I'm trying to keep things brief here. It's trying to take 30 years worth of problems and putting it in 5 minutes.
Well, we have your testimony in writing, so as well.
Okay.
So that's
now,
helpful.
Oh, very good. What I'll address on that, that top sheet there addresses the damages to the farm, the financial impact on last year's crop. And as of last year, the worst of our concerns had to do with wheat and crimson clover. And also it seemed to be problems in big fields only. The birds seem to be adapting as there's getting more and more of them. Their diets seem to be changing, and now we need to be concerned about all the crops. So basically those figures there are based on about 1,300 acres of the damages, which if we're successful, I figure we can hold it to about a 5% damage. The other expenses has to do with time we've taken away from other enterprises to either chase the animals or we try various things to try to keep them from the fields. One reason we asked for some of your help, working with the USDA, there's a fellow by the name of Scott Warner, we contacted through the Oregon Clover Commission, that's helping us with a product that's developed on the East Coast that you spray on the crop that is tastes bitter to the birds and also has an ultraviolet light a visual to them, so once they taste it, then they associate the vision when they come back. We have had a heck of a time trying to get OKs to do experiments with this, and we've been about 3 years in the process just coming up with a 10-acre experimental zone. What we've done so far has been successful, but again, we're asking some aid there to help speed the labeling of that particular problem, that particular product. Another thing, agency things that would help us. Over the years, it's been spotty. There's been people that have been able to help us. Back a number of years ago, Ernie Giese was with Fish and Wildlife, aided with us getting permits for pyrotechnics and educating us on the different types of things, the propane cannons, the Mylar tapes, the scarecrows, the fake coyotes, flags, scarecrows, all the different things that we're trying. Then when he retired, there was a gap in there to where we're having trouble renewing our permits and things. And then later, I lose track of time here, but maybe it was 6-8 years ago, Senator Gordon Smith's office had got some aid for us, and a fellow by the name of Mike Slater was hired. And again, he picked up the difference there and helped get us these permits. Also, education was important. There was times when we were threatened to be taken to jail because we were out there making noise with our firecrackers and one thing or another, and the neighbors were upset. And he was instrumental in getting the local county sheriff and the different agencies together so we could go ahead and do what we needed to do. So this is, again, where this task force will help us in tying all of those things together. Let's see, permits. I could touch more on the goose thing if you want me to, but to make it short there, I guess I'll summarize and say, working together, we can economically, solve this problem that's been building for the last 3 decades.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. I do have a question,
sure.
Because this is certainly not the first time that I've heard about it, but maybe you could talk a little bit, and the department will be coming up here in a minute, so I'll be asking them the same question, as far as what has been done, Senator Johnson, I'm sure you've been following this in the past, and is this the first task force that's being proposed?
May I respond, Madam?
Yes, please.
I don't know if this is the first over the long history of predatory issues with respect to agriculture. What we're hoping to do is to keep the cost of this task force down to an absolute minimum. I was so concerned about the issue that my office hired an avian biologist to come in and give us some recommendations. Mm-hmm. We couldn't get the farming community to settle on what recommendations should go forward and what shouldn't. There is so much intertwining between federal protected migratory birds and state that what we really want to do is to use this task force as a forum to work out the issues and then come back with a recommendation. I presume, given the magnitude and the growing magnitude of the problems, that others have tried to form groups to work on this. We're really looking for a legislative imprimatur on a task force so that we can call in experts, they can help us keep the costs to a minimum and come back with a thoughtful recommendation.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for this panel? Looks like on this side. We'll start with Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. Going over the pink sheet, which lays out the fantastically horrible timeline, and I was looking for the U-picks, and one of my closest buddies was the one that used to go on behalf of Farm Bureau and go to Bethel and negotiate with the U-picks up there. But propane dynamite, scarecrows, flags, coyote silhouettes, we've tried everything, and they're still here. And they're multiplying. Do you have any objections to lengthening the hunting season and shooting them?
May I respond?
Should I'm asking
respond?
You.
Yeah.
No, we have no objections to lengthen the hunting seasons. We've tried that. We've tried being able to actually harvest more. The regulations through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, through the Treaty Acts and everything that they'll tell you we can't do. We've in every road that we can think of, an extended season through from October 1st to April 15th while they're here. That's what we're hoping maybe this task force can sit down together and put some power behind some of the recommendations that would work. But we have all these treaty acts that they're continually telling us that they can't do anything about. And
Who's telling you?
U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
We'll have the department come up here.
No, that's a different department.
Different department.
They can talk about, also, they coordinate with U.S. Fish, so we'll have them come up and talk about that. Senator Hass?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have some experience here, too. I was in a helicopter in my previous life, and a goose crashed into us, or we crashed into him. Senator Johnson is familiar with this. She was involved in her previous life. And we had to make an emergency landing. Since then, we followed this, and from what I gather, this area along the river in Columbia County is somewhat of a goose.
Well,
it's a freeway for geese. And I have a similar question in that I look at these three pages going back 30 years and U.S. senators and congressmen, and I just wonder, you know, what a task force will do. Given this history, and it feels like it's time to actually do something rather than a task force.
We'll ask the senator to answer
If I could respond, Madam Chair and Senator Hass, I think what we're going to try to do is to bring forward some concrete proposals. We needed to get harmony among the agricultural community with respect to what methodologies of control could be used. Obviously, if you begin to take lethal measures, there are groups that need to weigh in on how that can be accomplished. There's the need for harmony between the federal regulations and the state regulations. What we're really hoping to do is to bring forward either for the 2010 session or into the next regular session a suite of bills that would try to deal with this. It has the appearance of being an intractable problem, but we would like to set the table with the legislature's help for one more shot at a task force that would try to get the right people at the table to bring forward some possible solutions. Is a growing problem. I, too, have the shattered bubbles out of a Jet Ranger. They got all four of them, and it's a very serious problem.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I'd like to make a comment.
Yeah.
A couple of you have asked if we had a task force done before. We have had, as you see, plenty of people on the ground, but we've never actually gone to this kind of a strategy, and that's why we're coming before you now, is it's kind of like, okay, we need to do something different. This would be different, a little more powerful, we hope.
Yeah.
Because in the end of all of this, the scarecrows, the extended seasons, we have too many birds. And we've got to figure out, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and those powers to be need to figure out how to feed them and how to keep them off of our crops. And that's why we're here today, is it's kind of another tool. Maybe we'll try this and see where we can get with it, and hopefully there's going to be some help from you guys.
I would just conclude by saying, Madam Chair and members of the committee, there are some novel approaches in other states that we want to take the opportunity to look at, including lethal takings with processing for food banks. That's been explored on the East Coast, and we just need a forum with a high enough degree of credibility, and that would arise from a legislative creation to be able to coalesce all the groups and have a discussion about what the possible suite of solutions is.
Okay.
I think Senator
Byer. Sure, because you didn't sign up.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And
we have one more person that would like to speak.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. So who we have, is it Don Anderson? Okay. And then next up, actually, I'm going to call up the department. So I know that Kurt's here somewhere. And then we'll have our last panel before we go on to our last hearing. Okay.
My name is Don Anderson, and I'm a farmer on Sobeys Island. Mine's the bluish-greenish sheet, and it's about geese numbers. At present, there's 170,000 cacklers in the Willamette Valley in western Washington. U.S. Fish and Wildlife wants 250,000. There's roughly 12,000 duskies, which is a special Canadian goose. the U.S. Fish and Wildlife want at least 25,000. There's at least 100,000 of other Canadian geese. There's 60,000 geese just north in the Skagit Valley of snow geese, which is expanding rapidly and then extending into the Willamette Valley. If you figure geese eat 1 pound a day, and most people figure 1 to 3 pounds, and using the minimum, each geese, you need 1,800,000 pounds of feed to feed every 100,000 geese. So to feed 300,000 geese, you need 108,000 acres of green feed. And geese like green feed. And I will looking at your carpet here, and I wish my red clover fields looked this good from geese. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay, thank you. All right, I'm going to ask Kurt to come up and respond to some of the questions that have been raised, and then we'll have our last panel up. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I did bring some prepared testimony here today. Copies are being handed out to you. I'll be fairly brief on that. I know the hour is getting late. We appreciate the opportunity to be here today. Senate Bill 622, as was previously discussed, would create a task force on goose control and goose depredation, and the bill would ask or require that the Department of Fish and Wildlife provide staff support for the task force activities. As was mentioned, geese are managed in Oregon, as are all waterfowl, under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918, and primarily under the Federal Management Authority. The states do have the opportunity to influence management. We participate in the Regional Flyway Council and do set seasons to hopefully address some of these issues, but nonetheless we're working within this federal framework which constrains us in many ways. Some of the considerations that go into these setting of these seasons are commitments to Alaskan natives and their requirements for subsistence needs, as well as sharing between the states within the Pacific Flyway. As you heard discussed here, the goose population in the Willamette Valley in northwest Oregon has changed and absolutely has changed significantly over the last three decades. Prior to the 1980s, approximately 20,000 geese wintered in the Willamette Valley. Those were almost all from one subspecies, which are referred to as the dusky Canada geese. We now currently have between 200,000 and 350,000 geese wintering in the Willamette Valley in the northwest corner of the state. A large part of this increase has been a shift in the wintering grounds. These geese used to winter in California's Central Valley. They, for the most part, are not, many of them are now not going that far south. They're stopping here in the Willamette Valley. That may be attributed to different agricultural practices or any number of reasons, but nonetheless they are now wintering here, and you've heard the angst and the problems that they cause. We have over the years, and I think it was mentioned, we've had these discussions on what we can do to help alleviate some of these concerns or alleviate some of these problems. We did in 1998 develop a goose depredation plan. That plan has never been fully funded, and it's certainly, that's now over a decade old. I think it's and the department feels it's certainly worth taking a look at this with the agricultural and other interests, and would be happy to provide the support for the task force in that endeavor. With that, there is an appendix of some of the things that we have done over the years, and some of them were alluded to in the earlier testimony. I will just very briefly highlight that we have implemented early seasons on local Canada geese. These are September seasons. We have also adopted rules that allow for essentially the taking of eggs in areas where hunting cannot be effectively permitted, for instance, in golf courses and municipal inside city limits, essentially. And we have worked diligently to try and One thing I did not mention is the dusky Canada goose population has been in decline at the same time that these other goose populations are increasing, and they're perpetually a candidate for listing. We've been doing all we can to make sure and assure that they're not listed under the Endangered Species Act, but that does constrain our hunting opportunity.
Do we know why that particular species is declining while others are on the increase?
Sure. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, dusky Canada goose primarily and almost exclusively nest on the Copper River Delta in Alaska. During the 1964 earthquake, the delta had, I want to say it was like a 6-foot rise in the delta's elevation, which made what was once a nesting area that was completely inaccessible to predators now suddenly an area that is easily accessible to predators due to that change in water level as the delta rose, or is now higher in elevation above the mean water level. So those populations have been in general decline. They're also very susceptible to hunting. As any of the hunting groups can attest, the dusky Canada geese they easily decoy. They'll come into smaller pastures, smaller fields, and just generally easier to hunt. And at the same time, we've had the shift in the other subspecies, the shift in wintering grounds from the south and California Central Valley up here to the northwest.
All right, any questions? Senator Boquist, Senator Atkinson?
Yeah, Madam Chair, just quickly, and Kurt, you might not know the answer, but I'm just throwing another idea, because I was sponsored the UPICS one time around, and there's all kinds of tribal issues in this, but has the U.S. Fish and Wildlife ever approached this from a different perspective and tried to convince one of the tribal groups to come down here in the off-season? I'm serious, and hunt them down here as part of the tribal agreement? Has that ever been tried?
Senator Dingfelder, Senator Boquist, not that I know of. I can't say absolutely the discussion never occurred, but I'm not aware of it if it has.
It'd be something that could be explored.
Task force figure out how to do that.
I see that Senator Johnson's taking copious notes, so I think that's what she's cribbing right now. Senator Atkinson, did you have a follow-up?
No, Madam Chair.
Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. Mr. Melcher, appendix bullet point number 2. The department has initiated late winter hunting seasons in Klamath and southwestern coastal areas. But you just heard testimony that all the geese haven't got that far south. They're all in the north. They're in the Willamette Valley, where if you're on one side of the freeway, have to take a little exam sponsored by your lovely department if you want to go and blast these things. But they're here. They don't move on. They come for Christmas, and they stay all winter into the spring, which is when they make the most damage. Why not take them when they're here?
Yeah. Chair Dingfelder, Senator Atkinson, and that bullet is referring to another species of Canada goose problem and issue and problems we've had in the Klamath area with regard to, I believe, it's white-fronted Canada geese. So we've had a late season for that species in Klamath. Up here in the northwest Oregon zone, because of the constraints, essentially we have hard management targets currently on dusky Canada goose and the take of those geese. And so we've had to limit seasons based on essentially quotas in the management areas. And I believe we have extended the season, I want to say, perhaps through February. So there's late season opportunity up here as well. Certainly not, we don't have seasons open in April. But those are things we can look at those things, but we're always, as you know, we're working through the federal framework to do the best we can to address these issues.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Kurt. Appreciate it. Stick around. There may be some other questions. We have 3 more people would like to come up. Roger Beyer, Trevor Steele, and John McCulley. Is that right? John McCulley, did I get that right? Okay. Roger, why don't you get started?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon Seed Council and the Oregon Dairy Farmers. Both Oregon Seed Council and Oregon Dairy Farmers support this legislation, this approach. Grass seed comprises 25% of the Willamette Valley. Geese like to eat grass. That is their main food source. The grass seed farmers have tremendous problems with crop damage in the area of because of geese. The dairy farmers, specifically the dairy farmers in northwest Oregon and Tillamook County, have their own problem with their own specific subspecies of the Canada geese, the Aleutian Canada geese, one are exclusively there. Those are also a threatened or an endangered population, so the dairy farmers in that area have their own little subspecies problem. So, Madam Chair, the Oregon Seed Council and the Oregon Dairy Farmers are ready and willing and able to help in this task force. We also would, from a personal note, support, I think as Senator Atkins said, blasting them. That is a very effective management technique for geese, and I would like to correct for the record, he said on a certain side of I-5 you have to take a little test before you can hunt them. Actually, you have to take that little test to hunt them on either side of I-5 as of last year.
As of last year. Mm-hmm.
So with that, Madam Chair, I will be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John McCulley. The hat I'm wearing today is as administrator of the Oregon Clover Commission. And the commission supports this idea of trying to find out better ways to control the geese population. And the specific thing we're interested in, Mr. Dobbin talked about some of the research that we're trying to conduct. And we have run into innumerable problems trying to conduct this research because of different laws governing how we can use this biocontrol product. It's a product that is currently registered for use on golf courses, airports, and industrial places, but we're trying to then take it to the next step where literally hundreds of acres can be treated. And I think one of the issues that we would like to see the task force address is all of the restrictions on the ability to do research to address this problem. So we commend the bill to your support and look forward to working in the future on it.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Trevor Steele, City of Eugene. And I just wanted to address the -2 amendments briefly. The -2 amendments were amendments that we had actually asked Senator Johnson to draft up, specifically the piece with the aviation component. City of Eugene has had numerous problems with bird strikes around our airport. Our airport is built on the nearest flat land around, which happens to be on a former wetland. So the geese tend to congregate around there. And unfortunately, we've had problems with people hunting in the area. When they shoot at the geese tend to scatter and get in our airspace and get in the way of planes. So we want to make sure that the task force addresses the needs of aviation as well.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Steele, any questions for this panel? All right, thank you very much. Okay, anybody else like to testify in Senate Bill 622? Come on up.
All right. Catherine Venata testifying on behalf of myself as a Columbia County landowner. I've long watched my fellow landowners in Columbia County struggle with the goose problem, and I'd just like to talk about something that hasn't been talked about today, and that is the bacteria left behind by the fecal matter from the goose population and how the landowners can sometimes get dinged for that when that is not actually their fault, but the fecal matter is there because of the roving goose populations, and as water quality standards get more stringent, and especially with the problems with the bacteria standards that we're currently having with the municipalities, and trying to make sure that on how we're counting bacteria, I would just like to put the fact that we should also talk about the fecal matter left behind before the goose populations and how that is not the fault of the non-point source landowners in the situation. But also, just on a different note for my day job, we have trouble with wildlife getting into our treatment ponds on our industrial facilities also, and we can also face water quality violations sometimes because of the wildlife populations and what they leave behind, even in our treatment ponds. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Catherine?
Okay. I just started talking about that. Nobody.
All right. Seeing nobody else would like to testify without. Okay. Brian, come on up.
I just want to, this obviously is a problem, and I just would like to make sure that the task force doesn't go in there with preconceptions on what the best way to control geese is, because I think you know, I've heard a lot of good suggestions, and I've heard a lot of suggestions have been tried, but...
Brian, can you restate your name for the record?
Brian Wagoner from Tualatin River Keepers. You know, I think using the best science available, addressing all the issues, including water quality issues, and we need to open up the box to make sure that maybe the mix of crops we plant, that our tracking geese could be changed. Maybe the location of farms right next to the river might be something we could look into, relocation of this, so that we can find the best ways to live with the geese and minimize the impacts, the economic impacts they have to our farmers and to our airports. So.
Thank you. Okay, anyone else for the gavel falls? Okay, with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 622.
That's right.
Thank you. And, colleagues, I'm going to reopen up a work session on Senate Bill 629, and Beth is going to tell you why. So I'm reopening up a work session on Senate Bill 629.
So the fiscal that you had before you when we were actually in the process of the work session was a minimal expenditure impact. And actually, fiscal has reissued an updated indeterminate fiscal impact that you have before you. And seeing as how we need to be considering the fiscal and revenue statement press before passing out any bills, we're just going to take a look at it. Basically, it says that the Department of Agriculture indicates that the fiscal associated with creating the program is expected to be no fiscal until grant monies become available. The potential fiscal impact this might have on counties is indeterminate, as the timing and potential amount of grant requests are not known at this time.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Przanski.
I move that the committee reconsider the vote that it took on Senate Bill 629.
Okay. Senator.
Got to suspend the rules first.
Oh,
yes.
Suspend the rules
yeah.
first. Madam Chair.
Actually, he has a script, so you can let him do it.
I'm just trying to move through this.
Right. Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on SB 629.
Okay. Senator Boquist moves that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 629. This motion is undebatable. So is there any discussion about it? Any questions? Okay. So those are the opinion that... Yes, those are the opinion that rules be suspended for the purpose of considering the vote, reconsidering their vote on this will say aye. Those opposed say no. Are there any objections? Okay, seeing none, motion carries. And the rules have been suspended.
Madam Chair, I move that we reconsider the vote by which SB 629 with the dash one was sent to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Okay, it was actually sent to Ways and Means.
With the Ways and Means.
Yeah, with the Ways and Means. Okay. Senator Boquist is moving that we reconsider the vote for Senate Bill 629 that was sent to Ways and Means with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any questions? Okay. Any objection? Seeing none, motion carries. Vote has been reconsidered.
She has to tell us it's because of the fiscal. You got to review the fiscal.
Yes. Yeah, so just, again, for the record, that the fiscal is indeterminate and that's everything you have it before you.
But we're going to Ways and Means still, right?
No.
Yes.
Yes.
Still going
it's
to ways
still, it says it's
still going to Ways and Means.
So if it has no fiscal just for the authorization.
Yes, and because it's indeterminate as well, but it's the authorization because we're setting up,
gotcha.
Even though there's no money, we're setting up a new program
gotcha.
So they can
Madam Chair,
receive the grant.
SB 629 with a due pass be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, Senator Boquist has moved Senate Bill 629. This is as amended, isn't it?
As amended with the dash one.
As amended to the, with the due pass recommendation, be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, we'll redo the vote.
Senator Boquist?
Yes, quickly.
Senator Sullivan?
Aye.
Senator
Hatch? Aye.
Senator Shadrick?
Yes.
Aye. With that, the motion carries, and we, again, don't have a carrier because it's going to Ways and Means, and I will now close the work session on Senate Bill 629. Thank you, Senator Boquist, and committee members for bearing with us on that. And last but not least, we will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 482. We appreciate your patience. We'll have Beth review the bill and the amendment. Well, actually, we don't have the amendment yet, correct?
Yes.
But
well, Madam Chair and Committee, Senate Bill 482, I'll be very brief because there's people in the audience who I think are more capable of suggesting that or talking about the suggested language for the amendment. Senate Bill 482 requires local governments to establish drinking water overlay zones. It also goes into boundaries for those overlay zones, and there is suggested language that has been requested from LC that was distributed through our email distribution as well as available in the back.
And Senator Brzozinski, did you want to say something before I invite the panel up?
Nope.
Okay, so with that, I will invite John Brown and Carl Morgenstern to come up, please.
While they're come up, I will say the reason I introduced the bill, because I agree with the gentleman that coming forward, that we should do whatever we can to make certain that our municipal water sources are, in fact, protected from being contaminated and having disasters from that contamination.
Okay. Thank you. Welcome, gentlemen. And for the record, please state your name.
Thank you. Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, my name is Carl Morgenstern. I'm with the Eugene Water and Electric Board, Eugene, Oregon. And my understanding is I'm going to give you a little background on what the amended language is. Basically, the bill has been basically rewritten with a new amended language. And so the bill's intent now is to provide additional or strengthen protections on municipal drinking water systems. And as you'll see today, it's really focused, at least initially, on the three basins, that the rule that exists in DEQ's rules. I'll get a little bit more into that. So the bill focuses on protecting critical municipal drinking water sources from impacts associated primarily with development. And the bill does a number of things. First, it provides municipal water providers legal standing and requires counties to provide notice when there is land use change requests. Right now, municipals are treated just as the rest of the public and aren't aware of a lot of land use changes and requests that go on. So this would provide water providers with status that allow a dialogue to happen with the county around certain developments in drinking water source protection areas. It allows local governments, counties, and cities to actually implement a protection overlay district with stricter ordinances or codes around hazardous material storage and use requirements, septic system sightings and densities, riparian setbacks. And this is really an opt-in option for counties. This is not a requirement. But what it does do is it puts DEQ on the hook to provide guidance and assistance when counties are trying to develop these overlay districts in areas where they have support from their population. The bill also amends the existing three basin rule to include additional health and safety requirements for the protection of these drinking water areas in the three basins. This is the Clackamas, the North Santiam, and the McKenzie River basins. It requires DEQ to evaluate development for impacts from water quality or to water quality from siting of septic systems, and this includes a cumulative analysis of the impacts of those systems. Right now, when a septic system is sited, it is looked at solely on the parcel that it is going into, so it is not looked at in relationship to the adjacent parcels. It looks at managing stormwater runoff on site from development in these three basins. It increases riparian setbacks to 150 feet from the high mean watermark. It allows water providers to work with DEQ and DEQ to require action if the analytical data shows that there are actual water quality impacts from developments going in along the rivers. And then it requires establishment of a septic system inspection program in these three basins that requires every septic system in the three basins to be inspected on an 8-year rotation. And this also requires DEQ to establish a certified inspector program to support that piece of the bill. And it allows the EQC to raise fees to cover these increased costs to DEQ and or the delegated local government. The bill does not relate to forest practices or agriculture activities. It allows DEQ to delegate the program to the county or local government under a binding agreement where that binding agreement provides clear roles and responsibilities. And it provides, and that binding agreement also and provides adequate funding to the county or city that's taken on or being delegated to. Enforcement of this still remains with DEQ under the three basins rule. And so that's, in a nutshell, what the amended language does with Senate Bill 482. And I would like to just briefly, I provided a testimony from the Eugene Water and Electric Board for your reading pleasure. And I'm just going to summarize some of the points in that. First of all, as most of you know, is that without drinking water, clean and abundant drinking water, really the economic engine of Oregon and our social and environmental quality pretty much ends. And so really what we're trying to do is look at starting to protect these critical systems that are providing drinking water, in this case, to over 700,000 Oregonians, to start thinking about, as we're looking at the impacts of climate change and reduction of water resources and disruption of water resources from diminishing snowpacks, is to start looking ahead on how we're going to protect these for future generations. And we're not saying that water providers aren't doing anything to protect their water sources. We are. In fact, EWEB takes pride in its drinking water source protection program. We spend $500,000 a year solely in source protection efforts in the McKenzie. And a few examples of this include our development and implementation of a watershed emergency response system, which uses geographic information system data to make sure that first responders get critical information in a timely manner. It coordinates the use of equipment and resources for 27 federal, state, and local agencies, and it has predetermined response strategies if there's a spill. And this is a program that has been nationally recognized and has received awards. We've also working with the agriculture community to reduce chemical use while trying to increase the farm's economic viability. We want to keep farmland as farmland and prevent it from being developed. As part of this effort, we removed 44 tons of old agricultural chemicals, DDT, paraquat, other chemicals from farms at no cost to the farmer for proper destruction. And we're also looking at opening or working with the governor, Oregon Solutions, to open up local markets for farmers that tend to pay more and get food into our schools. We're collecting water quality data in partnership with the USGS around runoff from forestry, agriculture, urban developments, impacts from septic systems, and pharmaceuticals. We're evaluating currently right now the impacts of clusters of septic systems on water quality, and working with Lane County and the University of Oregon is leading a research effort looking at Lane County code and how that code helps or harms source protection efforts. And those pieces of the code that actually help source protection efforts, looking at how is the county actually implementing that. And that is working with the county. In fact, the county cannot be here today, but wanted to relay that their Board of Commissioners did pass support for this bill, Senate Bill 482, yesterday. Mm-hmm. And finally, just another example is we're working with OSU around research of climate change impacts to not only the McKenzie, but all the Western Cascade systems. So all these things are great things we're doing, but EWEB is limited in what we can do because we don't have regulatory jurisdiction over the areas that actually supply our citizens of Eugene with drinking water. So what we're looking at here is that authority lies with the counties that cover these watersheds right now. But in some cases, these watersheds actually consist of two or more counties, like we have Lane and Linn County and McKenzie, which makes it a little bit more difficult when trying to implement an ordinance with a county because you have to work with two counties or you have very different code that affects your watershed. So really, this bill enlists the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality to expand its existing rules to include additional health and safety requirements for protection of these three critical municipal drinking water sources. And what I often hear, actually, from folks when we talk about the quality of the McKenzie is it's incredibly clean water. And people say, well, why all the fuss over development and along the river's edge or installation of clusters of septic systems when your river's so clean? Well, I spent 10 years working for the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality cleaning up hazardous waste sites. And in my experience of that, and before that I worked with a consultant cleaning up Superfund sites, and my experience basically tells me that it is too late and often impossible to clean up a pristine water source to its original state after it becomes contaminated. What is accomplished in these cleanups is that these sources are cleaned up to acceptable levels of contamination. It is also incredibly expensive to clean up these sources, not to say the fact that drinking water treatment plants like EWEB's would have to increase the cost of treatment. So McKenzie River is the lifeblood of EWEB and the citizens of Eugene, and we're working hard to take care of this source. However, we have no regulatory authority or say in how land use decisions or other actions are carried out in the watershed that move us toward that tipping point where we start seeing impacts on water quality. The previous Oregon legislature felt these three basins were critical municipal water sources and passed a bill to eliminate new or increased issuances of wastewater discharge permits. What we're looking at today is to consider amending this rule to allow management of development in a way that helps protect these valuable resources for future generations of Oregon. Thank you.
Okay. John, why don't you go ahead?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Brown, 101 East Broadway, Eugene 9741. Although I am a member of the Eugene Water and Electric Board, I'm here as an individual today, and I'm not stating any particular position on this bill from that board. I have a long-standing history of being proactive and reactive in protecting water sources in our community. I've been doing it for over 40 years, and I continue to do it until I'm gone. Partly my reason for being on the Eugene Water and Electric Board. And a very quick example, recently we had a home built 120 feet from the McKenzie River, and in 18 months it was over the river. Not one jurisdiction could do anything about it. It was condemned and abandoned, a brand new home, right above EWEB's intake. Not only could EWEB not do anything, DEQ wouldn't do anything, nobody would do anything. And so I took it on myself to get the money and the permit to tear it down before it entered the waterway. But I was very surprised to see a responding email from one of the jurisdictions in the state of Oregon saying, quote, tip, you should know that a home falling into the river really isn't any different than a tree, unquote. And I believe Senator Prozanski can confirm that. That said, this is an incredible resource. I find it ironic that I sat here earlier today and I heard about increasing penalties to prevent what, or to find what we're trying to prevent. You can never really clean a water source. Once it's gone, and it's gone forever. You use a chemical to reduce a chemical or reduce a biological or some other type of effect. I've also recently, we just found in Linn County, the source, the headwaters of the McKenzie River had a 1,000-gallon diesel tank. Linn County took over a defunct Clear Lake Resort. Single-wall construction, 1,000 gallons of diesel, 20 feet from the riparian edge with a 200-gallon impoundment. I want you to think about that. Forest fire, car hitting it, somebody shooting it. We have 1,000 gallons of diesel into the most pristine lake in the state of Oregon. Nobody could do anything about it, and we had to be proactive and do it ourselves. We're still trying to get the permits to move that tank away from the water source. What we're trying to do is prevent having to invoke fines. We're trying to prevent something because it's a lot easier to be proactive than reactive, and to think about having to drink the water I saw on that previous slide today is beyond comprehension. I mean, this is something to me that I know there may be testimony about an unfunded mandate or something like that, but I believe there probably are the resources to deal with this. This doesn't mandate it. It allows them to have the authority to be flexible. But I believe the money's probably there, maybe not the priority. Thank you so much.
Thank you, gentlemen. Questions for this panel? I do have one question for EWEB, and actually I'm going to ask the Department of Environmental Quality to come up because I didn't hear you talk about the Safe Drinking Water Act in your testimony at all. So I don't know if you want to add a little bit about the requirements under the Safe Drinking Water Act that you deal with.
I think, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and I think DEQ could probably speak to this more intelligently, possibly, but the Safe Drinking Water Act requires certain things associated with a monitoring of the distribution system, treatment of that system, and basically addition of chlorine to surface water sources, and then the monitoring of that through the system, and then the providing customers the knowledge of what the quality of their water that they're drinking. Some of the things that is interesting and what is required of that monitoring by EPA under this the federal act are for chemicals that basically aren't being used in the watershed. For example, there are pesticides today like hexazinone and triclopyr and imazapyr that are being used with frequency, but yet DEQ or EPA do not require that to be monitored at the intake. Same thing goes for obviously for the new contaminants like pharmaceuticals and stuff that we're starting to see. So it is fairly limited in its scope and breadth as far as the water quality contaminants that we're concerned with, but it is, I think DEQ could probably do a better job of
and I'm
going to explain that tie-in.
Come up here right now.
Thank you.
Is there other questions, Senator Prozanski?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I just want to give the committee a little bit more background on John Brown. John and I served together on the Eugene Police Commission for about 6 years over the last 8 years. Got to know him really well. He's an individual who not only talks the talk, but he walks it. He's funded his on it at his own and set up coordination for cleaning up the rivers. He's a river boy just like Senator Atkinson is, and a heck of a fisherman. And he's an individual that basically has gone up and every year will put together cleanups of both the McKenzie and the Willamette in the Eugene Springfield area from the homeless camps. And basically getting all this residue and everything else that you can think of that could be flooded into the rivers if it's not removed after the camps are shut down before we go into the winter. And so, you know, John's an individual here speaking from his heart and actually practices what he preaches by using his own efforts and money to maintain those qualities for not only his own pleasure but everyone else's.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming here today. Appreciate your testimony. I'll have the DEQ come up and answer those questions and can provide some more background. And then we'll hear, next we're going to hear from Dan Bradley, Justin Gwerk, and, did I get that wrong?
No, that's right.
Okay. And Art Schlack. Okay, whoever wants to go first.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Christine Svetkovich with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality.
Greg Aldridge, Oregon Department of Environmental Quality.
There's some of the questions that were raised that I can answer, and some of them I can't today, and some are probably more appropriately answered by the Department of Human Services Drinking Water Protection Program.
You can start off by just reminding the committee who has purview for what, because you know I'm very familiar with it. I'm not sure that all the committee members are.
Okay. So the Department of Environmental Quality, we work on with communities all over the state on the source water assessments. So about 9-10 years ago, we started work on doing source water assessments for the drinking water areas all over the state. And so our job is actually to work with communities on different tools to protect their drinking water sources. I don't know the details on exactly what DHS's role is in that, but I know that they have the jurisdiction over implementing the Safe Drinking Water Act in Oregon. But I don't have the specifics, and I'm happy to follow up if
okay,
like.
Well, Department of Human Services oversees a community, small community water supplies of drinking water systems, and we've done quite a bit of work over the past few years to strengthen that program, so it's a lot better than it was. But so the bottom line is Safe Drinking Water Act is implemented by both the DEQ and the Department of Human Services and the Public Health Division, mm-hmm. If you want to add to that. Can you talk a little bit about the tools that you provide, assistance that you provide to communities, and are there any requirements at this point that for source water protection or wellhead protection that you implement?
My understanding, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, is that there's not any actual requirements from the Department of Environmental Quality, but we provide a number of tools such as example ordinances. I do know that there are some communities around the state that do have ordinances for different ways to protect drinking water. We do a lot of mapping for communities around the state to show where sensitive areas should be protected first, perhaps. We do a lot of education. We go around the state and we talk to different communities about what we know about what's in their areas and working with community groups to figure out what's best for them, for that community to develop action plans.
Okay, so there's no statewide requirements right now for setbacks or buffers or anything for surface water supplies. My understanding is there is wellhead protection requirements. So, and that's a big source of drinking water as well, so you may want to say something about that.
I don't have the details on that, but I'd be glad to follow up with you on that.
Okay. So you can provide that to the committee members. I think that would be helpful background. Questions for the department? Jason? Or Senator Atkinson? Sorry about that.
Thank you. I'm looking at the amended version that was just handed out to us.
The conceptual amendment.
The conceptual amendment. Section 3 looks like this bill would give you a tremendous amount of rulemaking authority. And under Section 3, Sub A, it's Sub B on the third page. Require periodic maintenance and inspection of all individual and other water and sewage treatment systems. Would that not create a giant fiscal on this bill?
Chair Dingfelder.
Enormously big.
Chair Atkinson, yes. DEQ, yes. I have not run the numbers yet because the final amendment did not come out from Legislative Council in time, but I would expect that it would be a large fiscal.
would, thank
follow
you,
up.
Follow up. Could, in those, working with the good senator from Lane County, I think it would be helpful to run a fiscal that included that and run a fiscal or run a version of it without that and compare the fiscals. Because to me, that, at least that just gleams at me of not being able to accomplish what the bill is, given that that fiscal would be giant.
And Senator, I think that the and I'm not sure if it's in this conceptual amendment, but the bill allows DEQ to set a fee to cover those costs.
Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Atkinson,
you're correct.
If you would like us to do that, we can do that.
Definitely.
Well, if just to follow up, if you're going to require that to be reviewed, every septic system in the state of Oregon, all individual sewage treatment systems in the state of Oregon, every 8 years is going to have to pay a fee, I think you're going to have some political issues that you probably haven't compensated for.
Okay, this is not their bill, so
I'm just encouraging you that way.
Okay. All right, thank you. Any other comments or questions?
Just one comment, Madam Chair. Because I just wanted, you made mention there's no existing setbacks on surface waters.
Required at the state level.
At the state, under the Oregon Forest Practices Act, there is setbacks from all forest property along streams.
Yeah, there's the Forest Practices Act requirements, but specifically for protecting drinking water, there's not a statewide sort of requirement for
yes, Madam Chair, to some
the
degree
DEQ,
from the DEQ, correct. Right. But the drinking water, the classes of streams for drinking water and domestic water supplies are covered by the Department of Forestry and under the Forest Practices Act.
Right. And
just for clarification.
No, thank you for that clarification. It under the Forest Practices Act, which would not necessarily apply to municipalities unless their drinking water supply was in forested areas. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's a 70-foot setback, 100-foot permitting.
Thank you for refreshing me on that. And, of course, there are setbacks required for fish-bearing streams that differ from that. But you are correct. There are certainly local ordinances. And in the metro area, there's what's called Title III. And we have I worked for several years on that. And a model was set for all of the communities within the metro area. And many of them, I think all of them, were required to adopt those, but it was mainly for riparian protection and not drinking water protection. But it varies, but there's not a statewide setback for drinking water protection, as far as I know.
Commander, I'll follow up because if you remember, the Department of Forestry reversed the original ruling, and we supported it, and that just dawned on me, where we made all the streams have some sort of say. I'll follow up on that. But.
And I think the Department of Forestry may be in the room, so if we have time, we can bring them up. But thank you.
Not today, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. And we'll get what would be helpful. I mean, this is part of the conundrum, I think, that the public also deals with. And I think it would be helpful to have a matrix of all, because we do have, you know, 12 different agencies that have some purview over water in the state. So if you can put together a matrix that shows DHS, DEQ, Department of Ag, and under the Department of Forestry. And I'm trying to think. I'm sure there's some other folks I've left out. And Water Resources Department is sitting here, so if there's something I've left out, they'll let you know.
Chair Dingfelder will do that.
I think that'll be helpful for us to have as we move forward with discussions on this. Thank you. Okay, Dan Bradley, Justin
Gere,
and Art Schleck. And I'm going to ask if you can limit your comments to 3 minutes because we are running out of time. I'm going to start losing members.
Chair Dingfelder, I assure you I will be quick.
Okay, thank you.
My name is Dan Bradley. I'm the general manager of the North Clackamas County Water Commission, which is comprised of the city of Gladstone, the Oak Lodge Water District, the Sunrise Water Authority, which takes in the Happy Valley, Damascus area. I have the dubious distinction of being picked to speak on behalf of the Clackamas water providers,
mm-hmm.
and we have some real concerns with the bill. We feel that major parts of it are redundant. We feel that the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act together give us a lot of protection. There are several things in the bill that we do like, being able to comment on land use actions and to have some. We're concerned about the overlay zones, and one of the concerns is if, and I haven't got to fully read the Second Amendment, but we fear that we may not even be able to improve our intake structures, and the city of Lake Oswego and the city of Tigard are preparing to merge together to where they're going to have to go into the river and improve their structure, and we fear that this may not even allow them to do that. One of the things that we'd recommend, and we work very, very well in the Clackamas. We've worked very well with USGS on pesticide studies. We've paid for two of them. We also have stream monitoring stations that with USGS that we've paid for, and they're online. You can see them anytime you want for different water quality parameters. Right now we're working with DEQ on another pesticide study on the Clackamas. Once we find those results, then we work with our watershed council, who goes out and actually works with the landowners to correct what they may be doing, how they're applying pesticides when they use Roundup in the spring or whatever. So we're very comfortable right now that we don't need another layer of regulation. And so what we'd ask is either to hold off on this and form a work group, because obviously I'm not agreeing with my water brethren from south of us, and the Clackamas providers are not. So either a work group be set up in the interim to talk about this and flesh out what we see as very positive things and take out the portions that aren't as positive. So I'd be pleased to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay. Seeing none, thank you for your testimony.
As
we appreciate.
Side note, I do agree with keeping geese off the golf course.
Appreciate your input. Okay. Justin? And then Art Schlack. Sorry to hear. Okay, Dan Eisenbeiss, why don't you come up?
Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, my name is Justin Garrick, and I'm appearing before you today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Nurseries. I appreciate the opportunity to express our concerns about the safe drinking water overlay zone proposed under this bill. To make best use of time, I'll skip the introduction and say I have reviewed most of the conceptual amendments. However, our concerns, I think, are still not addressed completely. It seems that Senate Bill 482 attempts to address drinking water quality problems by creating a new land use regulatory authority at the local government level. Drinking water quality is already protected under stringent state and federal regulations administered by both the U.S. EPA and the Oregon Department of Human Services and Oregon DEQ. By attempting to regulate drinking water quality at the local level through a zoning overlay, this bill threatens to upset a fully functional regulatory program. This was addressed in a question by Senator Atkinson. Local governments don't have the staff, expertise, or the financial resources to undertake a substantial new mandatory obligations imposed by the bill. I note that DEQ is mentioned as providing enforcement and oversight in the conceptual amendment. However, I would like to see, once the amendment is drafted, to see exactly how that's going to be done along with a fee structure. The OAN is concerned that Senate Bill 482 would give local governments a statutory authority to zone farming practices out of existence. As written, the bill would flatly prohibit prior to the conceptual amendment, flatly prohibit or create considerable hurdles to basic agricultural activities on farms that exist within an overlay zone, including fertilizer and pesticide storage and application, farm vehicle fueling, and outside storage of farm vehicles. This extraordinary grant of power could empower a local government to regulate an agriculture operation out of existence if the jurisdiction was so inclined. And I heard mentioned earlier that this was not intended to address agricultural interests. However, in looking at the conceptual amendment, I think Section 3 is not drafted yet to take that out. Senate Bill 482 might even raise constitutional taking concerns because it doesn't exempt any existing operations from its scope. It has the potential to deprive property within an exclusive farm use zone of all economic value. As a result, it could amount to an unconstitutional taking of private property. Thus, the fiscal impact would not only include the staffing costs to local governments and the regulatory costs to impacted landowners, but also the potential significant compensation payments that might be due if a taking is found. In conclusion, the bill seems to create more problems than it would solve. It would further complicate an already crowded regulatory environment, and it might impact the viability of Oregon's agricultural interests. If a work group is formed, the OAN would appreciate being a member to help work some of these problems out of the bill. Thank you for your
time.
Attention.
Go ahead.
Honorable Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Daniel Eisenbeiss with the League of Oregon Cities. I'll try to keep my remarks brief given the hour.
Because you'll start losing people. Yeah.
First,
thank you.
It's clear that the underlying intent of Senate Bill 482 is admirable. I think we all want to work toward better protection of drinking source waters. However, the bill as introduced is not workable in the view of the League of Oregon Cities. It is a large unfunded mandate on local governments that would have a very significant fiscal impact and contains some vague language that could be quite problematic. Water source and tributaries combined could, in the cases of Corvallis and Wilsonville that draw water from the Willamette River, extend to all tributaries above or potentially below their intakes in the Willamette Basin, requiring local governments, both cities and counties, to adopt overlay zones and hold hearings on proposed developments within those overlay zones at very significant cost. Furthermore, the language of the bill as introduced is quite prescriptive. We would favor an approach that allows local governments to craft solutions in acknowledgement of local conditions. Also, the prescriptive language could require local governments to take actions that may trigger Measure 49 claims, something that certainly we don't want to be forced into doing if that isn't necessary. Also, just to note how difficult this could be to implement, urban areas with pre-existing uses could have uses that are simply not allowed under the language of Senate Bill 482 as introduced. That could come into play in Medford, where Bear Creek runs through the middle of town and eventually drains into the Rogue River, which becomes a water source for Gold Beach or in other parts of the state. As was mentioned, many communities around the state have taken local initiative to adopt overlay zones to protect source waters. For instance, the city of Springfield has a source water overlay zone that recognizes time of travel zones and builds a regulatory structure around that. The city of Pendleton is working with their groundwater protection zone and surface water vulnerability assessment as they review their comp plan and are in discussions with Umatilla County about how they can prevent developments that could impact those areas. Briefly, the conceptual amendment that has been put forth, I think, moves in a better direction from our perspective. Certainly, providing notice and standing to water suppliers in county land use decisions is something that we would welcome. Permitting cities to opt in to guidelines that are established by DEQ could be workable. We want to add to the toolbox that we have available, not up in the toolbox. Frankly, we'd have to take a closer look at the proposed expansion of the three basins rule. And I would just note that we'd want to make sure, too, that if there's any delegation of authority to local governments, that that's something that's not simply imposed on local governments, but something that local governments agree to from the get-go. With that, I'll close my testimony.
Thank you. Questions for the league? No? Okay, thank you. And last up, Sean Julians, Catherine Bonetta, and then I think Brenda Bateman from the Water Resource Department wanted to say a few words. Welcome, Sean. Why don't you get started?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Sean Julians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. We hate safe drinking water. Just kidding, Madam Chair. Obviously, we don't. But we do have significant concerns with the bill. I apologize, Madam Chair. I just got the conceptual amendments when I got here myself and went through them. I'll point out a couple things because I realize we're after 5 o'clock and we want to get out of here. Section 2 in the proposed amendment is a mandate. It's not an optional requirement for local governments. It says they shall require the following. Sub B is very troubling, and the land use change request and proposed development meets requirements of, I'm assuming that's supposed to be ORS 537545. That's exempt uses for water. The back of the bill has amendments to exempt uses for water and requires certain people to get a permit that are currently exempt uses. I think you know, Madam Chair, where we stand on exempt uses and the lengthy conversations we've had. The last thing that I would comment on, too, Section 4, which talks about the three-basin program, and I'm not familiar enough to speak to the program in general, but it does talk about one-eighth of the septic systems in those basins being inspected and fees on top of that. We're very concerned about the impacts that that will have on existing homeowners in those basins. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Sean. Will you go ahead, Catherine?
For the record, Catherine Venata, Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. We also have grave concerns with this bill, not about the aspirational goals of the bill, but the way it's structured. Specifically, in Section 1 of both the bill and the proposed amendments, a reference to hazardous material in ORS 466605. We're not quite sure why that is there. If you go to 466605 and see what is there, then you see a broad expansion of how we particularly usually look at water quality in this state is through the use of water quality standards, and specifically there is a water quality standard for drinking water, and when it is the most and it's a beneficial use listed on specific streams within the state, and when it is there, everybody who discharges or uses those waterways does have to pay attention to the drinking water quality standard. Specifically in Section 3, we think that this is a mandate that is not limited to the three basins. I think that Section 3 is broader and could be viewed statewide as other people have looked today. And specifically, we think that Section 3.1 it says restrict or prohibit the use of hazardous materials which are potential groundwater and or surface water contaminants. Again, it references back to the definition of hazardous material in the DEQ statutes, and those DEQ statutes, just so you know, are on spill response and cleanup of hazardous materials. So not quite sure why that is there. We do think that that would get anyone who stores materials which could fall under those classifications. We do think that that could potentially get industrial areas, and really not really that was not the intent of the legislation. And the third thing is that we object to the to amending the three basin rule, a administrative rule through the legislation. If we're going to start amending DEQ water quality administrative rules through legislation, then I think there's a lot of folks that would have some things that they like to do. I think that that is a precedent that you might want to think about before undertaking. And finally, about Section 3 and DEQ resources, the 20% cut list that DEQ is currently prepared for the Ways and Means Committee has most of their water quality policy folks disappearing, their water quality standards folks disappearing. And I think that this would be a lot of policy and permitting and standards work that they just weren't anticipating. And I think that our priority should be on our current programs. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for either Sean or Catherine? All right. Thank you. And Art, did you want to say a few words? Because you were out of the room. You signed up. So if you do, why don't you come up? And go ahead, Brenda.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Brenda Bateman with the Water Resources Department. And we just wanted to bring four technical and fiscal implications to your attention so that you have them on your radar. And I'm actually working from the conceptual amendments that came out today. I'm looking at Section 5, which would amend ORS 537, 545. And Sub 1 would require all individual domestic groundwater systems to obtain a permit from the department when a parcel partition would propose more than one domestic system. Domestic system we often also call an exempt use well. And so we wanted to let you know two things that we had identified here. One, this would have a fiscal impact on the department because of the resources required to review exempt use applications where we do not currently do so. So that's one thing to flag. And the other piece was, in several areas of the state, we currently do not issue new permits, but we do allow exempt uses. And so this language, which would impose the requirements on exempt uses, might effectively eliminate any new parcel developments in the restricted areas that have already been outlined. So we wanted to let you know about that. The second piece in sub 2 talks about demonstrating no hydraulic interference, and that specific language may be a problematic standard to enforce. First of all, interconnection or interference between wells occurs all the time, but doesn't always present a problem, a water supply problem. So the phrase that we usually use at the department is substantial interference, which I would offer up as a suggestion for possible language. And lastly, using that standard of no hydraulic interference with surface water is a very high standard, maybe impossibly high. And we're thinking if there's a specific concern with nearby streams, then we may want to consider identifying or defining a buffer zone where you might or might not want to put a well. So just offer those up for your consideration, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. All right, you get the last word.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. I apologize for not being here when you called my name. Seems like there was a land use committee down the street, and I had to testify on two bills there. So, again, I apologize. Let me just say that counties, on behalf of the Association of Counties, we're very much interested in the bill. We've looked at the bill as originally drafted. We understand there's amendments. I received an email about 11:30 this morning that had amendments attached, but I really have not had an opportunity to take a look at that. We understand that they are intended to change at least some of the requirements as it might relate to local government, so we are really very concerned about new requirements that would apply to counties in particular, as it would relate to the fiscal impact of additional work that we would be required to do at this point. So with that, Madam Chair, I guess I'll just stop here and say that as this bill continues to evolve, we would certainly like to be involved in the changes that may come forward with the bill.
All right, thank you. Any questions for either of them? All right.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Anybody else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 8482, and we'll close the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources and see you.